Three.
Fine guy, everyone. This is Professor Amon Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University, Long Beach, African Studies Department, along with my co-host, historian Joe Hembrick, longtime educator for Compton Unified School District and administrator, and Linwood Unified School District, where he was the first African-American head coach, as well as one of the first major conscious administrators in the Compton Unified School District, sharing a lot of light and consciousness to his students. But we appreciate his in-depth study of our history and research, where he was a history major when he was in college, and he turned that into a commitment to educate our young people and anyone else to our righteous history as a people, the best of our thought, practice, and understanding as a people. Tonight, we have one of the most exciting presentations that we've ever had on our show, one of the most important. We have a very important person that is going to present this evening. He not only represents the struggle from the standpoint not of writing about it, not of hearing about it, but of participating in it. I mean, he has a long history as an educator at Compton College and at one of the major universities in California, California State University, Long Beach, where he taught Black arts. We are grateful and honored to have Brother Akinsanya Cambone, a curator, along with his wife, and founder and owner of the Cambone Pan-African Art Studio, as well as museum. I've had the honor of a brief tour, and it is packed with historical personalities, as well as drawings, as well as bronze sculptures. I mean, it's just like a treasure. You go in there, you think you just found a treasure of Black history in bronze and in art. And we deeply appreciate his hard work to keep our struggle alive through art. Just a little bit about Brother Cambone. Akinsanya Cambone, a.k.a. Mark Tatema. You know, he has a map. Cambone is a multimedia artist. He has a master's degree in fine arts. He is a prolific artist. I can attest to that. And over his life, has worked in all media. Currently, he is working in oil, watercolor, charcoal, pen and ink, pottery, ceramics, and bronze sculpture. Cambone's artworks are influenced by his life experience. I'm going to read that again. His art is influenced by his life experience. This includes being stricken with polio at the age of 3, military service, United States Marine Corps, political activist, college professor, public speaker, and extensive travels in Africa. Akinsanya Cambone is a revolutionary artist. His philosophy is, I get it, art is not for art's sake, but must be used to uplift humanity. And I would start with that, and we'll add other things as we go. But I am just honored to have my friend, colleague, person I have the utmost respect for because of his contribution as a member of the Black Panther Party of Sacramento. And at the same time, you very seldom find professors that are activists and that are committed to our struggle. The Black Panther Party of Defense was one of the leading organizations during the 60s, and he was a part of that. But at the same time, he took his training in the military, to the organization, just like Jijaga Pratt. But at the same time, he developed his skills as an artist. And as I show you some of his stuff, and when we share screens, we will go into that. But I can sign you the style, which is a little bit about his history highlight, and tell us about the Cambone Pan-African art, which he's a Pan-African through his art and through his practice and through his travel. So would you go ahead, Professor Cambone?
Yeah, Brother Ra. I guess I can talk about what you show on the screen, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Nothing's on here now.
Roger Key, you want to put something on? That first plaque with them people. Yeah, that one.
Oh, that piece there. Now, that you took that before I fired it. It just has glaze on it. It looks a lot different now. If you were to see it now, it wouldn't look the same.
Okay, yeah, because you was going to glue it in.
That's a piece of Queen Nani of Jamaica. She was the leader that fought against the British in Jamaica for Jamaicans' independence from Britain.
Okay.
Matter of fact, she's the one who invented camouflage. Yeah. And this one here is not finished also, but this is Dedan Kumathi Wachuru and Bayumungi, his right-hand lieutenant. And they fought against the British also in Kenya back in the 50s. And the thing about that, the brother Bayumungi fought for the British in Burma. And he learned how to make guns when he was in the military fighting for Britain. But then when he got back to Kenya, he joined the Mau Mau and he fought with the Mau Mau against the British for Kenya's independence. And they acquired it. That's a piece of me and a bronze piece in the studio. And that's Charles Deslandes, the leader of the 1811 slave revolt in German Coast, Louisiana. It's Charles Deslandes and two of his lieutenants. And you know, what I do is a lot of these things I want to get cast in bronze. And I know that they have a lot of bronze work they're talking about right now that was stolen in 1897 by the British from Benin. And they're talking about returning it now. Well, the work that was done by the artists in Benin, those bronze casters, were things that the Oba or the king wanted them to do. But nobody does anything about the peasants or the people who were victims of slavery. So I take it upon myself to present this history of those where it is untold. Nobody talks about. This piece that I'm looking at now is the Ford Moore Bridge lynching, the last lynching in the United States, last mass lynching. And this was where they lynched two men and their wives. And both the wives were pregnant. One of them was 8 months pregnant. And I'm pointing to the baby on the ground where they cut this pregnant woman's stomach open and let the baby drop out on the ground.
So that's blood?
That's blood, and there's a baby laying in the blood. Okay. And they got all these people tied to a tree. This happened in 1946, the same year I was born. So that could have been my mother. And that could have been me laying on the ground there.
Yeah.
But you know, nobody talks about all the things that happened to us historically. And many of these things were unpleasant, but they need to be discussed lest we forget. And that seems to be what most people are doing at this point. They're not remembering our history. I brought up to Brother Ra when he was here about Brother Micah Johnson and Gavin Long. And that is not distant history. That just happened about less than 10 years ago. Micah Johnson and Gavin Long, and nobody talks about these two brothers. And it kind of upsets me because I know that these two brothers were veterans. One was in the Army, one was in the Marine Corps. Iraq and Afghanistan, that's where they served. And what happened with them is after they saw all these police killings, they were watching on the news, they just got to the point where they just got in the middle of a flashback and they just went to war against the police. And this is what they did. And I kind of think about these guys because, you know, I spent time in a war for this country also in Vietnam. And I know what a flashback can do. And I know that when you're in the middle of a flashback, you go into combat and you're not even conscious of what you're doing. But this is what we were trained to do. We were trained to kill. And once we go into that combat mode, then we're there and we're fighting. And these two brothers were killed for what they were trained to do. The only thing is, they saw the enemy as those who were killing their people on the streets in this country. And that's who they were fighting. And so they tell everybody, don't mention their names. So nobody knows the name of Micah Johnson and Gavin Long, because the people who they lashed out against were the officers who were killing African people in this country. That's what they did. So people need to look these brothers up and do a little bit of their history and find out who they were. I don't get upset when people are doing what they were trained to do by this government. And they were trained to kill by the U.S. Marine Corps and the United States Army. Yeah, after Orlando Castillo got killed, that's when these brothers just had enough. They were fed up when they saw this brother get shot in the car with his wife and his little child in the back seat. And they just couldn't take it anymore, and they just went off. You know, when I see stuff like this, I'm not mad at those guys. I understand. You know, I understand, and it's a shame that nobody says anything about this. Nobody talks about it. And I think it's something that needs to be talked about, because we have a lot of veterans coming back from Afghanistan to this day. And we still have these young brothers and sisters with us. And this stuff can happen again, because they were trained for war. And when you look at what's happening to the African community in this country, it's like a war zone. That's a photograph of some of the artwork in the museum. And it's a lot of stuff in that museum. So I could sit up here and I can talk about each piece for about 20 minutes. So we'd be like all day trying to deal with this. This is the Sphinx. And Nia Smith, is she on there?
Yeah.
Does anybody have any questions for me? Because, you know, I think it's better if people ask questions and I'll respond to the questions. Because sometimes, you know, you can talk and people listen to you, and some of the stuff you're saying, they may not even want to hear. But if they ask a question and I respond to the question, that's something that they want to know about.
All right. Linda, you want to start with you?
Okay, I just have one question. You mentioned a lot, and I'm still trying to grasp it all, but you mentioned it was an inventor of the camouflage. Can you repeat that, or did I hear you correctly?
That was Queen Nani of Jamaica. Okay. She was a sister that was the leader in Jamaica that fought against the British. And she trained the brothers that fought with her how to fight in the jungle. And she taught them how to wrap themselves in leaves and blend in with the forest. And when the British soldiers came marching through the forest with their bright red uniforms and big black boots stomping through the forest, all of a sudden, the forest would come alive with these warriors, and they would jump out and start killing these British soldiers. And they would always leave one or two alive so they could go back and tell what happened. And what they thought is they thought that the forest attacked them because of the camouflage the brothers had on.
Right. Wow, thank you. You said Queen Nani?
Nani, yes. Queen Nani of Jamaica.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. Sister Nia Smith? You have any questions? She's not on. Are you on mute? Nia?
Yeah, she's on mute.
Yeah, okay. Brother Hembrick, as a historian.
Oh, yeah, brother. Where is this museum located?
It's in Long Beach on Atlantic Avenue.
What's the address?
2228 Atlantic Avenue or 2240 Atlantic Avenue.
I have another question. In the museum, are there visiting hours or set hours?
It's just basically by appointment. You have to call the number and make an appointment. And then we'll go down and open up. We don't have a staff that stands in there and works for us. We have to work for ourselves. So ain't no sense in sitting down there in that museum when I could be down here in the studio creating art. So I spend my time in the studio. But if somebody calls and makes an appointment, I'll gladly go next door to the museum and open it up.
What's the phone number?
562-212-2299.
What's the nearest cross street in Atlantic that is?
Hill. Okay. Hill and Atlantic.
Okay.
It's north of Hill.
Is there an admission price if I have a group?
I don't know about that. No, there's no admission price. Any questions is hard like that, I got to speak to the director. Because I don't know the answer to hard questions.
Last question, brother. Can people purchase some of your art there at this museum?
Yeah, people can purchase artwork at the museum. They can.
Any other questions, Joan?
I don't have a question, but I do have a comment about the brothers Johnson and Long. What their, makeup was, like being ex-military. And I have a belief today that, our brothers that are ex-military can be schooling some of these youngsters out there shooting the wrong folks into, getting prepared for the right folks. Always a good thought. That's why, brothers that have that military backing that are in organizations usually get moved on because they don't want that stuff being spread around like, spooks set by the door. And I was showing that to all my students, Sankofa, spooks set by the door and all that, a dry white season about the massacre in South Africa, all that stuff my kids was getting. I was trying to persuade them, to change their aim. That's all I like to say.
It's a good point.
Brother Mashinda, how you doing? You have any questions?
No, not. I'm just chimed in. I'm just listening. Thank you.
All right, then. Brother Rashiki?
Yes. So we talked earlier, and you said that you taught at Long Beach State from what year to what year?
1984 to 2010.
Okay, so now when you, in the beginning of your courses, what do you tell the students about the significance of art and how it expresses, like the title of this show is Black Liberation Art. Can you kind of speak on that?
Yeah, I think that art is one of the most important things in any liberation movement or struggle. I think art is the people's history. It's the people's memory. And I think that any artwork that comes from an oppressed segment of society, if it doesn't speak against the oppression of our people, then it's worthless. That's just me. That's what I believe. I wouldn't waste my time creating art that didn't have any relevance to our people's struggle, because I think that's the most important thing that we deal with, is the struggle that we've been involved with since I've been on this earth.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Roger Key?
Not at the moment.
Well, Brother Campbell, you know,
yes, sir.
I went on the museum with you, and I urge everyone to go. I mean, like you said, he can talk on each piece and each exhibit for hours. But the most important thing is, what is the difference? Is there a difference between African art and what are the difference in the concept of Pan-African art? Because you have Jamaican art and personalities, and you have Black Brazilian art, and you have African-American art, and you have African art that is different among the various ethnic groups on the continent. Have you had any information on that?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of traveling on the continent, and I've worked with artists almost every place in Africa. And a lot of these guys, they work for who pays them or who takes care of them. That's what they do. When you look at the bronze work that France and Germany decided that they're going to return to Africa, to Nigeria, after all these years, over 100 years, they now decide they're going to return this artwork. But this artwork, and a lot of this stuff is worth millions of dollars, and they're returning it. But then when you look at it, it's the work that the king ordered the bronze casters to do. That's what it is. And it speaks to the king, the queen, queen mother, all of their attendants, all depicted in this bronze work. They don't have anything depicting those of us who was kidnapped and captured and taken as slaves. They don't have any of that, because that's not what the king wanted. So being a descendant of slaves in this country, I feel like it's my responsibility to pick up the slack that has never been picked up and deal with stuff that deals with the descendants of slaves and all of our struggles, all of our rebellions, and all the unheard Africans who fought in these different slave revolts, the ones who were lynched. And somebody has to tell this story, and I took it upon myself to be the one to do it.
Yeah. When historically, one of the first forms of writing were drawings on papyrus paper. And a lot of it was hieroglyphics. And a lot of it was based upon messages. And on the walls of the pyramids and on the inside. How do you see the Black Liberation Art Movement from the standpoint of the Holocaust of enslavement, and just when we were depicting ourselves and our culture before the European came on the continent? Is there some difference in that?
I think that what has happened to the art movement in the country and the world is that money gets involved. And a lot of people do art because they're trying to sell it. They do art because they're trying to make a living. They're trying to make money. And I don't fault people for that. You know, I think that that's a way to make a living. But I also think that if you come from an oppressed segment of society, you need to be talking about that oppression in your art. I think that you need to be speaking about the things that have happened to us historically. And many of these things aren't pretty. They're not beautiful, you know? And a lot of people want to see a pretty picture of an African child smiling. But, you know, a lot of kids are not smiling because they might be hungry or they might be living in a country where they lost both parents. You know, so you have to take this stuff into consideration. Somebody got to talk about Orlando Castillo and his family. Somebody got to talk about Mike Brown. Somebody got to talk about Tramir Rice. You know, somebody got to talk about these things. And I think that the way artists talk is through their work. And that's the way I talk.
You know, Dr. Chancellor Williams, when he wrote the book, Destruction of Black Civilization, he said he started his study of Black history by going to Europe to the British Museum. And he said the reason he went there is because they had stole all. That's where they stored all the information. How do you respond to the King Tut exhibit, the racist museums that won't let liberation art in it, because you had a sign saying Long Beach Museum was racist, and you know, when you picket them.
That's because they don't cater to our people. It's very seldom anything in the Long Beach Museum of Art that deals with African people. And there's a lot of African people in this community. And I think that they should at least have enough respect for us, enough respect for us to exhibit some work from African-American artists.
I have a question, Rob.
Okay.
Okay, Professor Cambon. Now,
yes, sir.
In 2000, let me see, was it 17, I think? Or, well, wait a minute, 2019, I went to D.C. and I went to the African American Museum. Have you been there?
Yes, I have.
So what is your take on the African American Museum in D.C.?
I think you get a good historical view of what's going on in this country, but you don't get all of it. There's a lot of stuff that you don't see in that museum. Can I get some more water?
You want to take a break for a minute and come on and get some water?
Yeah, she is coming. Yeah. Yeah, you got one.
And while he's taking a break, can I ask a question so he can think about it?
Yeah.
Okay, and think about it for a moment. I was thinking about the young people. Is there any opportunities for young people in the area to study under you?
You know, I allow anyone to study under me who's serious. If they're serious, I don't have a problem. At this place, this studio here, we've had free art classes for children for over 30 years, right here, every Saturday. And even when I was teaching at Cal State Long Beach, on Saturdays, I would have students from the university come and help teach the classes here with the kids. And they could get extra credit for helping teach the art classes. And anytime I find a young person who's serious about art, I don't have a problem with working with them.
When I went up to the museum, he showed me some of the art that some of the children had done. Some had came and picked up their art and some hadn't. And he had a whole display of children art at the museum on the Cicillin. Roski, you had another question?
No, not at the moment.
Okay, now, I was asking you about the King Tut exhibit. How do you see that effort by Europeans to try to define our art or even claim it was there?
Well, that's what they do. I mean, you can talk to a lot of scholars, African scholars, and they won't even be clear that Egypt is part of Africa. They act like they don't even know that. When they talk about Egypt, they talk about it someplace other than part of the African continent, when in fact it is. And when you go to Egypt and you travel around Egypt, you'll find that they try to make it look as though these people are not Africans. A lot of Arabs have come in. And they, I guess I talked to a brother from Kenya who's a professor at Kenya. And I was asking him, why were there so many Arab looking people in Egypt? And he said, it's been that way ever since the Arabs came to Egypt. If you're a black person, you cannot marry. You cannot marry a woman. If you are an Arab, you can marry African women. You can marry three or four African women. And that's legal there. But if you're an African, you can't marry anybody unless you go to Sudan and find you a wife. And I found that interesting that all these brothers, these African brothers in Egypt, have to go to Sudan to get a wife because they don't allow them to marry the women of Egypt, especially Arab women or women that are mixed with Arabs. Because most of the mothers were African and the fathers were Arabs, and the children from that relationship, I mean, it's, but one of the things you'll find about all of North Africa, Morocco, Egypt, all of them, is the closer south you get, the darker the people get. Like if you travel in Egypt and you go from Luxor all the way down to Abu Simbel, and you'll find that when you get to Abu Simbel, you'll find that the people are darker there because that's close to Sudan. And, it, you know, it's the same thing. It's racism that Europeans have taken all over the world. And it's alive in Africa, too. You know, I mean, it's really interesting. I talked to he hung out with some brothers in a place called Dahab. And Dahab is a very interesting place. It's right on the Red Sea. And they got quite a few brothers with businesses there. And, you know, we kind of hung out and all the brothers would get together and we would talk. And they say, well, you know, they don't even try to deal with the women because they know that they're not allowed. It's just something that's not said, it's not written, but it's something that's known. It's just something that's known.
Brother Ra, could I, you know, appreciating what you said, brother, you know, but we oftentimes, you know, refer to, you know, Africa being disrupted, you know, once the European came, but I always tell our brothers and sisters, 1,000 years before that, the Arab came in doing it first, all along North Africa, like you said, and along the East Coast of Africa. And actually right now, for I guess about a decade or so, they've been chiseling on, you know, some of the hieroglyphics that are on those walls, you know, trying to take away the African originality of, you know, the things that were scripted on the walls and whatnot. And this is something, you know, that we got to acknowledge as a part of our history. I know Dr. Clark oftentimes talked about a book that he would write and he would probably need some bodyguards, and I probably would if I mentioned it. It was called The Role of the Bastard as a Factor in History, how the invader, you know, taking the native women and would use the offspring against the people of the mother, which, you know, which started that enslavement on the East Coast of Africa and drove a lot of people to Central and West Africa trying to get away from that 1,000 years before the European came. And this is the last thing I can make, and I spoke about this with athletics and community doing, you know, and I don't like to, you know, use an example like following the Hebrews all the time, but wherever they live, they have community centers. They have, you know, performing arts, they have gyms for working out, they have libraries, and us, as many professional athletes that we have and the amount of money that we have or they have. I can't think of one community center where our kids can go and see art like yours, books like Chancellor Williams, you know, have a facility so they can let off steam in the athletic realm and whatnot. And lastly, you kind of started on the answer of this about the African American Museum ending at the top with LeBron James. Is there any African bridge in the African American Museum that's showing where we came from other than, you know, us after we arrived here? That's the extent of my question.
Is that who is the question for?
You, sir.
Okay. You know, I've traveled in Africa. I've traveled to East Africa, West Africa, North Africa, South Africa. And there are places in Africa where there are Africans who are more confused than the Africans here. You got a lot of Africans in Tanzania, in Kenya, and don't go to Zanzibar. You find a lot of Africans in Zanzibar that think they're Arabs, and they actually believe that they are Arabs. And, you know, I mean, you don't really want to argue with these people because they really believe that. And if somebody believes something, that's just what they've been conditioned to believe over the years. And this is a problem that we have not only in this country, but we also have it in the motherland. We have the same problem. You got European dominating almost every country in Africa for years. And you have many Africans who are not even clear. A lot of the French colonies and British colonies, a lot of the Africans that run things, they feel like they're more French than they are African. You know, I've heard Africans even say this, and they want to be French and they want to be British because they think that that's better.
African people here like want to be Americans. Malcolm said that. So my other question is, when we look at, there are museums. I've been to a lot of traveling museums. In fact, Linda's working on her museum, traveling museum. She's working on plants and things. I know that a brother, I'll get his name in a minute. I played basketball with him. He has a beautiful museum that they bring out Black History Month and put on display. But many school districts don't want to pay them.
Oh, yeah. I think I know you're talking about.
Dave McLucas.
Yeah, McLucas.
The McLucas's. They have a beautiful museum, bro. Authentic pieces. Sidney Lee, he was a former student of Cal State Long Beach. He was in Lancaster. He moved to Vegas now. He had a museum. And we used to have a Black Museum on Santa Barbara, where the Magic Johnson Theater them are now. They had a museum there. And then at the same time, a lot of us use mules up and down Crenshaw. There's some Black mules. And I understand what Brother Hendrick is saying. A major place other than the museum in D.C. But there's a lot of little states, small other states, that have African-American museums. We have one in Los Angeles called the African-American Museum. So there are places, and now they have different themes and different displays at different times. But there are efforts. It's not as unified as it should be. It's not as major as it should be. Matter of fact, Brother Hendrick used to take people to it wasn't a museum, but to see that a place up north where they ran the people off because they messed up the water. I forget. I almost started the name. But anyway, there are efforts. But my question to you is, when you look at, I think it's C.R. James, some Stolen Legacy, and how do you equate the Black Arts Movement, because it was both theater arts as well as fine arts during the 60s when the Black movement was gone. There was an evolution of art, even as we talked about John Arterbridge and all of them brothers over at the Watts Tower.
Yeah.
That used to be a museum too, because Arterbridge was good at that. How do you see trying to, is it necessary to bring the Black, what do you think is necessary to bring another movement where your museum and Black art become relevant to people's lives? You don't even see people buying it and putting it up a lot.
I think that you have to get support from some of these African athletes, football players, basketball players, and a lot of these cats make some money. And what they need to do is they need to organize and support some of these places. You know, they needed to support the museum over there that John Arterbridge ran, but I don't think he got support from Africans. I think that when our people support us and our people are behind us, nobody can tell us what to put in it except for us. And we can put revolutionary art in these museums that really teach our young people what they need to learn. Malcolm X, he's one of my heroes. And he said that out of everything one can study, history is best qualified to reward all research. And in this artwork is the history. And this is the history that our young people need to learn. They got all this talk about critical race theory where they're not allowing the children to learn this history in the schools. And they all upset about it because they talk about how the little white kids are gonna feel bad, blah, blah, blah. Well, hell, they don't have to feel bad because they had a lot of white people that were heroes back in the day. They had a lot of white people that fought against slavery just like we did. They had people like John Brown. They can teach about him. Or William Lloyd Garrison. They can teach about him. And there were thousands of others that they could teach about, but they're too lazy to do the research. So they get upset because they found out that every one of their forefathers was slaveholders. George Lincoln, Abraham Washington, both of them. I don't care who they were. They still owned slaves and they still were not against slavery. They felt that we should be slaves. And I think that we need to realize is that what's going on in this country right now, you have all them young men who fought for the South. They fought for the Confederacy. When they lost the war, it was hundreds of thousands of them that were prisoners of war, and they just let them go home. They didn't line them up against the wall and shot them. They let them go home with their racist ideas, and their parents told them to become a congressman, become a senator, become a judge, become a governor. And this is what they did. So, and you even got some Negroes that were part of it. So, you know, you have to kind of look at this and you got to think about it and kind of be real serious about where we are today. When I was in Vietnam, I used to see these white boys talk about the next civil war. That's what they were waiting for. They wanted the next civil war. And this is in Vietnam. And I'm listening to them and I'm hearing them talk about this. They had the Ku Klux Klan and the Aryan Brotherhood and the American Nazi Party. All these groups were in Vietnam. And it was strange, but they all had the same flag. They all had that Confederate battle flag hanging in their hooch. And we would see that. And there was a lot of problems of race that they had in Vietnam that nobody talks about. Nobody mentions his long been jail. Nobody wants to say anything about that prison they had in Vietnam for African-Americans. 90% of the inmates in that prison were African-Americans in Long Bend. And after Martin Luther King got killed in 1968, those brothers rebelled in that prison and burned the whole prison down. Now, nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about it. Nobody even knows about it. unless they've experienced it. Unless they've experienced it. You wouldn't believe that America would have a prison for African-American soldiers. How many of you knew that? No, nobody knew it because nobody wants to talk about it. I'm the only one who talks about it. I talked about it in my little YouTube documentary on Vietnam. I talked about Long Bend Jail. I talked about the Klan, the American Nazi Party, Aryan Brotherhood, all of that. I talked about all of that. And I think that people need to understand that these organizations are still alive and they are still well, and they are organizing every day. They're organizing every day, and they ain't playing. You think the January 6th movement was a hoax? No, that's serious, and that's who they are, and that's what they do. All right. I think if we are thinking seriously, we need to start having discussions about that. Right, most of us don't want to talk about it.
All right. Sister Nia, you had your hand up? Or is that, you got to take your off
mute. Take it off mute.
It's down in the corner where the camera is. All right. Then do you have any more questions?
Not at this time.
Brother Hendrick?
Yeah, one quick one. I wonder if the brother, during his experience in Vietnam, did he happen to see some of the Twa people up in the mountains that the white boys used to try to shoot and the brothers would stop them? Did you have an opportunity to witness?
I heard about them. I didn't go up in the mountains. I didn't go up in the mountain country where they were. But I did hear about them. And, you know, I think that one of the things that kind of got me is that I was young and I was illiterate. And I started learning while I was in Vietnam. One of the things that happened to me is you cannot join the Marine Corps if you're illiterate. Okay? And I was illiterate. I couldn't read or write. And that's why I was drafted. So when you're drafted, they don't care whether you can read or write or not. But what happened is they took this young man, illiterate as I was, and placed him in an environment with all the other Africans that were there, were literate. They could read and they could write. And they were very learned. They were scholars. And they start putting a lot of us that were drafted, they start putting us down with history of things that we never heard about. They start telling us about the slave revolts that I never knew anything about. They put me down with so much history, I couldn't wait until I got out of Vietnam and got into Black Panther Party, and I was able to express this history and this knowledge in the form of that Black Panther coloring book. That Black Panther coloring book was a history book, and it was for people like myself who could not read, who were illiterate. It was never for children. And I know what everybody says. I know all the information that you read is this was a coloring book for children. It wasn't even supposed to be a coloring book. It was supposed to be a book for adults who were illiterate like I was. And that's who I was thinking about, because I know the effect that these brothers had on me, teaching me all that history, all that information that they were giving me about these slave revolts that I had never heard about. I couldn't wait to put my artistic skills to creating this coloring book. And then once the coloring book made headlines, the Black Panther Party came out and said, no, we never endorsed it. He did that on his own. And, you know, I did do it on my own, but I didn't print it up and start selling it in every office in the country. And that went on for about 2 weeks until the book made headlines. And then the Panther Party came out and they denounced the book, and they got me to denounce it too. And I denounced it. Isn't that strange how you denounce your own book? But when you're a member of an organization and the organization says, when you have your press conference, this is what you say, and you're 21, 22 years old, you say what you're told to say by the people that are on the Central Committee or the people who are above you in rank in that organization. And that's what I did. I came out against my own book.
You wrote a new edition, right?
Yeah, the new edition is out and is ready and it's finished. The one that they printed up and put out wasn't even finished. They just saw it, liked it, took it upstairs and started running them off. And then they start selling them all over the country. And then they try to say they didn't do that. Mm. Well, hey, who am I? Mm. I mean, I read Seize the Time, Bobby Seale's book, where he talks about the brother that did the coloring book was a young Panther with a low level of political consciousness. I read that in the book. And I was a young Panther, and I did have a low level of political consciousness. I would have to admit that. I was just learning then. I was a youngster. But now I'm an elder.
Okay.
So I have a question about that. So you went on and did what they told you to do, but if you had your way, you wouldn't have denounced it, correct?
Right.
Okay.
And then there was a meeting. We had a big meeting about the book. And there was a big table with all these people. There was some white folks from the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. There was also some white folks from the Weather Underground. And the white folks from SDS, they didn't like you to call police officers pigs. They said that a lot of white people ain't gonna like that. But the Weather Underground, they loved it. Those white boys, they said, oh, we down with this. You know, my position was, and I knew what was going on, even though I couldn't read. I was just learning to read. That's where I learned to read in the Black Panther Party. That's where I learned to read. Once I started learning to read, I started understanding things. And I'm reading things like quotation from Mao Tse-Tung. I'm reading things about Karl Marx and these are the things that I'm reading. I'm learning about the lumpen proletariat, all these big, long 50-cent words that I never heard before in my life. I'm learning what the meaning of them is. I'm learning about fascism. I learned that the first fascist was in America, not Mussolini or Hitler. 1866, the first fascist was the Ku Klux Klan. And that started in the United States of America. That was the first fascist organization. And they still exist.
Okay, so now another question about the Panthers.
Okay.
Professor Ra always speaks about the Panthers and when we talk and have these shows. So now, from what I'm getting from Professor Ra, is that some of the leadership of the Panthers basically was starting to, I don't want to use the word sell out, but go in different directions. What happened, in your opinion, or in your assessment, what happened to the leadership other than maybe COINTELPRO with the Panthers?
That's what happened to the leadership, COINTELPRO.
Okay, it was COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO is a counterintelligence program.
Yeah.
And they had infiltrated every chapter of the Black Panther Party with FBI agents. They were in the party. They were doing stupid stuff in the Black Panther Party, and Panthers were getting blamed for it. That's what happened. Some of the leadership were very good leaders. And I don't have a problem with most of them, you know? But then there were some people who were working for the FBI. And they were intelligent. A lot of them took control of different chapters of the party. And they set a lot of Panthers up to be arrested and charged with crimes. And some of those Panthers are not out of prison to this day. And I had my little run with that, too. I was falsely accused of a murder back in 1970. I sat on death row for a year fighting that case. I was threatened with castration. I had my hands chained behind my back. They came at me with a straight razor, had me chained to a radiator pipe, pulled my pants down. And, you know, this is kind of a horrible thing to have happen to a brother that was a Vietnam veteran. They got three Purple Hearts, you know, and you come back and you're almost castrated by your local police department. That's not a pleasant thing to happen. But when it happened, there was nothing you could do about it. You know, you just had to take it.
Okay. Linda, do you have any more questions, Linda?
No, I'm still absorbing all this and writing my notes.
Somebody come with some good questions now. Come on now. Put this old brother to work.
Now, you did. He did mention that it was he was revising it. So how can you get a copy since it's being revised?
You gotta call the number 225-4647. Call that number and you can get one. 562-225-4647. And they're collector's items, so I don't think there's going to be any more of them printed. I don't know. I think they're running about $50. That's why can't nobody afford them, and it's okay. But, you know, they're complete.
When you were in Sacramento,
yes, sir.
You were part of the organization at that time. What was it like? What was the experience like? What was the organization like? What were the goals, objectives, and how hard did they come at y'all? I read where they shot up the Panthers headquarters in Sacramento. But what was some of the things that y'all did to the community and raised the conscience of the community that you were proud of?
We had rallies. We had free clothing giveaways. We had a free breakfast program that was started in Sacramento, California. We had the first one, we spearheaded that one in the country, free breakfast for school children. And, you know, a lot of the work and a lot of the things that we did, medical programs for people that couldn't afford it, they sparked the government to do some things. If you look at what the government did, they took over the Panthers free breakfast program and they started feeding kids all over the country breakfast and lunch if they were from low income families. But most of the kids didn't want to be identified as low income. So they didn't want to come to the breakfast because they didn't want to. It was the way they did it was embarrassing. You have to have some kind of a ticket saying that you're low income. The way the Panther breakfast was, we just opened the doors and the kids came to eat. And we fed all the kids, black, white, brown, all of them, all the kids that came to eat breakfast, we fed.
Another quick question. I think it was in the 70s when the Panthers went to Sacramento with guns in a demonstration. Was there a Panther organization in Sacramento then, or did it sort of grow after that?
It grew after that.
Okay.
Yeah. It grew after that. There was a brother that was there when that happened. He was a mailman at the time. And after he saw what the Panthers did, he went to Oakland and got permission to start a chapter in Sacramento. And the brother, may he rest in peace, he was one of the greatest brothers that I ever knew in terms of his ability to organize and teach. His name was Omowale, and he made his transition a few years ago, but he was a good brother.
Okay, now, the challenge is that the Panthers had a 10-point program, and were y'all successful in the implementation of it in Sacramento?
you know, the in, all over the country, we had the same program, and we were trying to implement the same program everywhere in the country. Point number seven was one of the main reasons why many of us joined, and that was we want an immediate end to police brutality and the murder of Black people. That's one of the main reasons I became a part of it. And as you can see, we haven't succeeded in that. So everything that the Panthers were fighting for, our people are still fighting for it. Decent housing, decent education, everything that we were fighting for, we're still fighting for. Our people still need this. All you got to do is go back and look at that 10-point platform and program, and you will see all this stuff. Look at it. And the reason I joined, one of the things that I did when I was in the Panther Party, I illustrated the 10-point platform and program. Not only did I do the coloring book, but after the coloring book, I illustrated the Black Panthers Party 10-point platform program. And there's supposed to be an exhibit in New York in April of the Black Panther coloring book and the 10-point platform and program that I'd redone on 16x20 boards and painted them in oil. And they're in New York. There's supposed to be an exhibit in April. I don't know how that's coming, but that's what the knowledge that I have.
You mean April of 23?
April of 23, yeah. Okay. Jack Shaman Gallery.
All right. Any other questions, anybody? Well, we want to go ahead.
I was going to ask him, when you said they're in the museum in Sacramento, what is the theme of it or for the entire exhibit?
The museum in Sacramento? You talking about the Crocker Art Museum?
Yes.
What is your question about that museum?
Okay, the question is, if I'm telling somebody to look for that exhibit, what is the title of it?
Oh, Akinsanya Cambone exhibit at the Crocker Art Museum.
Okay, that's simple. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Akinsanya Cambone. Or you can Google the name Akinsanya Cambone, and I'm pretty sure a lot of that stuff will still come up.
Anything else, Roger Key?
I have one quick one, Rob.
Go ahead.
The name of the Black prison that was in Vietnam for Black soldiers again, how do you spell that?
Long Bend Jail. Hold on. Get my hat. I don't know how to spell Long Bend. I'm not sure. I want to give it to him right. Let me get my hat off the thing over there because I got a pin on it. Long Bend Jail. Yeah, LBJ, Long Bend Jail.
And while we're waiting, I want to take on, you mentioned the fact that, you know, Europeans and other groups are running, you know, all of the stuff wherever Black people live. And I just want to know, what was your take on the fact of the effects of colonialism and religion on us allowing that to happen?
Colonialism and religion allowing what to happen?
The fact that we're not running anything where we are as large groups, even on the continent.
No, we're not.
Just like here in America. Because, you know, I've talked to some Native people from like Ghana and whatnot. And, you know, they're big on Presbyterianism and all this and that. And I asked them, well, what about your indigenous religion that you had before you met these folks? The same
thing. You're right. There are still people that practice indigenous religions. But the only way you're going to find anybody revolting against most of that stuff is going to be young people. There's a bunch of young brothers that I met in, I forget, one year I was in Uganda. And a group called the African Heritage Promoters. And these were a bunch of young brothers. I don't know if a lot of them are still alive, but it's about 30 or 40 of them. And I traveled around with them speaking at different schools. And a few years later, I learned that half of them had been killed. When I traveled with them, I was worried for them for the things that they were saying. And they were clear that all of the rulers or leaders of every country in Africa are corrupt and they all need to be eliminated. That's what the Young Brothers were saying. And I was telling them, I said, well, do you think it's safe for y'all to say this? Because I'm going to leave and I'm going back to U.S. and y'all going to still be here. And they said, look, man, they said, this is our life. We got to live with this. And we either going to change it or we're going to die trying. And those brothers are very much committed, very much committed. I was proud to be affiliated with them, even though many of them are not with us anymore. They were young. I think I was in my 40s or my 50s, and they were like in their 20s, you know, young cats. Oh, Long Ben, I got a hat here. I don't know if you can see the spelling of Long Ben. Can you see it right there?
Long, but I can't make out Ben. How you spell Ben?
B-I-N-H.
Got it.
Yeah, they spell stuff kind of Long Ben. And, you know, it was wall-to-wall brothers in that prison. When I got back to the States, they made me a brig chaser because they couldn't put me nowhere else because I didn't get along with nobody. And they made me a brig chaser. So a brig chaser is the one who goes to the prison and picks up the prisoners and takes them out to work. Well, I would go pick up prisoners. I'd get about 30 to 50 prisoners on the back of a truck. And we'd load the truck up and they had sickles and hoes and all this stuff. And I'd take them out there and they're supposed to cut this mustard grass down. And I would just get them out there and I'd talk to them. And some of the brothers were from Long Bend Jail after they burned it down. Some of the brothers came there from Long Bend Jail. And then they burned it down, I think, a little bit later. Because I think King was killed April 4th. And they burned that prison down about maybe a month or two later. And I had brothers telling me the way they tortured them. They had some of these brothers locked in these. Have you ever seen these shipping containers?
Yeah,
they were locked in the shipping containers in 135 degree heat. And they would slide the food through a slot in the door. This is at Long Bend Jail. This is stuff the brothers told me about, the way they tortured those cats in that prison.
Wow. I'm ex-longshoreman, so I know what them containers are like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wear that Long Bend pin on my hat to honor the brothers that were in that prison. And nobody talks about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. The government won't say nothing about it. And I'm sorry, I don't never hear no brothers that were there come on the air and talk about it.
Speaking on the time that you were in Uganda, and I always praise, you know, General Idi Amin, you have any knowledge about if these brothers were, you know, taking a note from, you know, his influence, or was that before he came on the scene?
No, these brothers were more Pan-Africanists, and they studied Pan-Africanism. They studied Julius Nyerere, Kwame Nkrumah, Malcolm X. They study all these scholars, and these brothers are not... I don't think they could be associated with Idi Amin, you know.
Well, you know, the reason I praise him about the nationalism of the businesses and all that and getting the invaders out, that's the point I bring up about Amin, which all those countries need to do, then Black people be running their own stuff.
And they down for that. I sat down and I talked to these brothers, and what they believe, they believe that Africa needs to close all the borders everywhere. Don't let nobody in and get everybody that's not down out. This is what they want to do. It probably won't happen because they're not in power, but they're young cats. And believe me that in a few years, they might be in power. You never know. I remember when Odingo, Jinga, and what's his name? Burning Spear. What's that brother's name? the president before Moy, Jomo Kenyatta, Jomo Kenyatta and Ojingo Odinga. Now their sons are running the country, but their sons are just as backward as they are. You understand?
How do we introduce an idea to the group?
Brother Wazir?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to let the group know that I moved to Ghana and I built a factory there. And what I've noticed is our need is primarily financial so that we can build industry. And as I come back to the United States, I find there's an abundance of money available. It's just not a will on the part of brothers and sisters to come there and make those investments. I was wondering, what do you all think of that?
You know, I think that it's financial, but I don't care where you go on the continent. If you have any time you're dependent upon the International Monetary Fund for your funds, they're not going to any country that's going to be about the business of liberating Africa. They're not going there. The funds are not coming because the funds are controlled by the United States. And I think that we have to be realistic that if you have any kind of a revolutionary program that's going to be really about the business of liberating Africa, it's not going to get any funds from the International Monetary Fund. IMF not going to fund that.
I wasn't really speaking of an organizational funding. What I found was, as an example, my son is independently wealthy, and I'm in the process of trying to persuade him to consider putting some of his wealth into Ghana. I work with a heart surgeon. He is independently wealthy, and he's bringing some of his money to Ghana. And from my perspective, with the right flow of finance from we in the United States, we have the ability to not only entrench ourselves, but to build in such a way that we can improve the economy of that country and those people.
I think that would be a great idea, but the only problem I see is that everybody has to be on the same page. If we're trying to build Pan-Africanism throughout the continent of Africa, everybody has to know what Pan-Africanism is, and they have to be about the business of building it. You can't think you know what Pan-Africanism is and not have a clear understanding of what it was. I know that Julius Nyerere and Kwame Nkrumah had a problem with the concept of African socialism and Pan-Africanism. Nkrumah was of the thought that socialism is not particular and it can't be particular to Africa. There's no African socialism, no Cuban socialism, no Russian socialism, no Chinese socialism. Socialism is just socialism and it has to be applied scientifically. That's what Nkrumah was saying. And I learned from Brother Bunting that Nkrumah was right. And Nyerere told Brother Bunting that he realized that Nkrumah was right. And when I heard Brother Bunting say that, I said, damn, I was so glad to hear that because, you know, Bunting was pretty close to Nyerere when he was in Tanzania. So, you know, there's a whole lot of things. And I think that people have to really be clear ideologically if you want to do anything to develop and build Pan-Africanism in Africa. There's a lot of young people who are going to be down with it because they're studying what Pan-Africanism is. And don't go there thinking you know what Pan-Africanism is and get in a conversation with some of these young brothers and you don't know what you're talking about, because they do. Well, a lot of them brothers is clear.
I was fortunate when I was a young man, I was involved with Elijah Muhammad, and I saw some of his business development. Amen knows what I'm talking about. And one of the things he said that stuck with me, I'm now in my mid to late 70s, he said, as long as your mouth is in another man's kitchen, you basically will be subservient to him. So what we did, we built a factory to produce or process the rice of the local farmers. And the better we can produce and process their rice, the more they are inclined to listen to us and organize around our programs that we put into place. So I'm simply saying that there's an opportunity for Americans who have expendable income to come there and provide the necessities for the people who are in Ghana. And I think there are about 30 million. And from that 30 million, develop an economy, a small internal economy through the industry that we build.
You know, the great Dr. Osagyefu Kwame Nkrumah once said, the independence of Ghana means nothing unless it's tied to the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. So, you know, Ghana is one country in Africa. What Nkrumah was trying to build was a United States of Africa to unite the whole of the continent, which was a humongous task. And, you know, I don't know. I think we need to, you know, you get off into a whole lot of things when you start talking about economies. And people say, well, what kind of economy do you want to have? Do you want to have capitalist economy or socialist economy? And I know that the Nation of Islam, because I used to study them, I was with the Nation for about a year after the Panther Party was torn up. And the economic system that the Nation was pushing was basically a capitalist economic system. And the capitalism that they were producing, basically, you had to be a Muslim to benefit from it. That's what I saw. And it didn't take me but a year to see it. And I saw clearly what Malcolm X saw, you know?
Well, you know, I'm not talking about the organization per se. I was simply speaking about that one principle. Now, in 84, I designed a development project at the University of Denver. I began the implementation of that project in 2007, because it took me that long to accumulate the funds I would need to go into a country, get land, and meet the tradespeople who could do the work I needed done. And now I'm able to provide jobs. I'm able to provide food. I'm able to assist in education. We finance the education of at least 4 students. I know that's a small number, but it's something that can be done, and we win the goodwill of the people. And once we win the goodwill of the people, we have a chance of assisting them in their broader development. That's all I'm.
Did you notice the Chinese when you traveled around Ghana and what they're doing in Ghana?
There are some Chinese in some areas, but there are no Chinese in the area where I work, which is in the Ashanti region in Tepa, in between Kumasi and Sunyani.
Well, last time I was there, I noticed the freeways and stuff, and they were all being built by the Chinese. And, you know, I noticed that the Chinese are building stuff all over Africa. And, I mean, you know, I guess I kind of, back in 1974, when I was first in Africa, I went to Benin, and I talked to a brother that was there, and the Chinese were also there back in the 70s. And he told me, and this is what he told me. Now, he said, you know, the reason they work with the Chinese is because the Chinese give them a better deal than the Americans or the British or any of the European countries. The Chinese give them. Now, I don't know how true that was. That was back in 1974. But the Chinese were there then, and I would imagine they're still there, and they've expanded all over Africa.
Let me just say something quick. Chinese in America, they own buildings and banks here too. But let me just say this, you know, Imam Wazir Muhammad, that's who that is, asking you questions. He has a history, a long history of investments in on the continent and working with the people. And the principle he's talking about, if we get some of the people with money here to start doing things in Africa, like feeding people, opening up businesses and putting some economic power in there, that we will have a better chance of organizing the people on the continent. And that's the principle that we all say, you win the people over with service and with, being able to do something for them and to them that is positive, which is correct. And I just want to say, assalamu alaikum, Brother Wazir, Imam Wazir Muhammad. And he did a lot. He got straight out of Compton, went to Centennial, went on to be an attorney. He was the deputy city attorney for Compton. And he's a traveling man all over. He travels and he practiced what he says. And I'm just deeply honored that he chimed in to engage in this conversation.
If I could share this angle, because I saw my son's ability to generate money, I've actually retired from my law practice, and I expect to be admitted into medical school soon. And once I finish the medical program, I'm going to quadruple my income, and then I'll have more money to put into the project that I'm speaking of.
Okay. That's beautiful. Brother, let me just say this. This has been one excellent show, Kambong, Professor Kambong. We want to thank you, and I'm going to get with Minister Wazir if he'd stay on so we can have him on to talk about investment and economics in Africa and his project to probably open up a hospital in Ghana or on the continent somewhere.
That's a good thing.
We want to thank you, Brother Kambong, for this excellent presentation. And Brother Wazir, if you'd stay on after we close out so we can get your information, and we'll have you on as a guest very soon. Any closing comments, Brother Kambong?
Yeah, why don't you bring these brothers by the museum, or they can come on their own or whatever? Because I'd like to talk. I'd like to talk to Brother Wazir a little more, not on camera, so we can talk. You know.
Where are you?
I'm in Long Beach.
Okay.
Can you give from you? Give your number again, please.
My number is 562-212-2299.
All right. So, Brother Rashiki, you want to tell them what's happening Wednesday?
And we close out? Sir. Thanks a lot, Professor Kambong. Appreciate it.
All right.
And thanks, everybody. Thanks for everybody coming this evening. As usual, we always have interesting and good shows, as usual. Now, and it's getting better and better as we go. Okay, on Wednesday, we have a brother named Kevin G. And the topic is how we address ourselves is power. So this brother is against the N-word. So I know that's going to be one of the main themes of what he's talking about. So that should be very interesting. So let's close out with saying each one teach one and conscious corner. Everybody have a great evening.
And Brother Campbell.